Hello and welcome to KUAR's Week in Review. On the program for the week ending Friday, June 9th, 2017.
The widely anticipated public testimony from fired former FBI Director James Comey spurs a political response in Arkansas as Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton dines with the president. State Democrats chime in with their critique of the across-the-aisle foe's relationship with the Russian investigations.
And applications for medical marijuana retail and grow centers are about to roll in. We check in with the soon-to-be state pot industry.
Neo-Nazis start to rally in Batesville. Ten Commandments go up at the Capitol. And will state highways get a boost under a ballot measure? A look at these and other political headlines is coming up.
How did sexism play into the 2016 presidential election? A poll from the University of Arkansas gives us an answer.
That's all in the Week in Review. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
And I'm Bobby Ampazon.
Well, probably the biggest news this week, nationally and possibly internationally, was the much-anticipated testimony by former FBI Director James Comey before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Comey was, of course, fired by President Donald Trump after Trump either disagreed or had some issue with the way Comey was conducting the investigation into possible collusion between Trump's campaign and senior officials in Russia. There's some disputed or at least contradictory statements given by the Trump administration immediately after the firing of Comey. At first, there was a memo written by the deputy attorney general saying it was about the handling of the Hillary Clinton email scandal. And next, you know, we had Trump go before NBC News and say he was going to fire Comey all along because he didn't like the way he was handling the Russia investigation. Comey opened by saying he was very confused and concerned over the shifting reasons given for his firing. And we'll play a short clip here.
Although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies. Plain and simple.
Of course, this was before the Senate Intelligence Committee. One of our congressmen, U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, sits on that committee. He was one of more than a dozen to ask questions. Here's one sample of a question he asked of Comey.
Let's turn our attention to the underlying activity at issue here, Russia's hacking into those emails and releasing them, and the allegations of collusion. Do you believe Donald Trump colluded with Russia?
It's a question I don't think I should answer. In an open setting. As I said, that we didn't. When I left, we did not have an investigation focused on President Trump.
Now, Cotton has a pretty decent relationship with President Trump. And in fact, this week, he was among six senators who dined with the president on Tuesday. And it's hard to tell where Cotton really stands politically on this. I think he's somewhat skeptical of the investigation and also some of the allegations. And I'll open this up to our panel here. What does Cotton's stance mean politically for him?
Well, Jacob? Senator Cotton certainly is not a fan of Russia as a country. He calls Vladimir Putin a dictator and a tyrant all the time. He hates other involved in the Middle East and backing up the Assad regime in Syria, whereas Donald Trump has expressed admiration for Vladimir Putin before. So they have different conclusions about the role Russia plays in the world, I guess. But Senator Cotton took the... It's definitely like a politically safe move for Arkansas. Over 60% of the state voted for Donald Trump in the presidential election. His poll numbers are still well over 50% in Arkansas. So Senator Cotton tried to derail Comey's testimony, the theme of his testimony, a little bit by asking these questions that he couldn't get answers to. So that way Comey's not saying, yes, there is a link. He's saying, I can't answer that. And the other question he asked that the editor of the National Review liked was he brought up that James Comey, when he was assistant attorney general under the George W. Bush administration, offered to resign. So he said, why didn't this rise to that level? That was Cotton's kind of question to dismiss how upset Comey says he is.
How does Cotton's position on this compare to the other members of the congressional delegation?
I would say the only difference really is that Cotton is in the limelight in general because he's on national TV all the time, but also because he's on this committee. generally, you know, it's always shocking to me that the congressional delegation, all Republicans, during the Obama presidency, every single opportunity they would issue press releases with really broad, strong, sweeping statements about the presidency. We've saw virtually no statements from any congressmen that chose to send it out. It's all responding to media inquiries. It's all really tame. French Hill told Drew Petrimo, who's in Washington, D.C. now, used to be at KRK, that protocol's not the president's strength, but that he didn't do anything wrong. He thought it vindicated Trump, proof they didn't do anything wrong. Rick Crawford, interestingly, today posted something about how he didn't like Trump's Cuba policy, which isn't totally new, but his reasoning was that it would give Russia too much influence over Cuba. So that's kind of funny, because he's not alarmed by Russian influence of the election, according to any public statements he gives.
Michael?
I think the Republicans, they want to be aligned, yes, with the president who's from their party, but I don't think they want to be too close to President Trump, because there is a lot of uncertainty with what's happening with him and how all of this could eventually play out. Senator Cotton has developed a little more of a relationship with the president. The dinner on Tuesday was said to not include anything about the Russia investigation, was more about advice and talking about world affairs, foreign policy, that sort of thing. But it's been interesting. You've also got Cotton, who has been what seems like setting the groundwork for a possible presidential run eventually, maybe in 2020, going to events in Iowa and building his profile among also New Hampshire and building his profile there. He's a young person. Maybe it won't be 2020, but it does seem like he's building this profile. But it was very interesting to see him in the limelight, taking about the 7.5 minutes that he had to give several pointed questions to Comey.
It seems to me like Cotton is, in a way, hedging his bet. On the one hand, he is traveling to Iowa, possibly preparing for a 2020 run in case the Trump presidency falters in a significant way. Well, at the same time, he's, as the New York Times called it this week, he's serving as a kind of coach to the president in trying to advance policy. He's also serving on some healthcare task force and also has been noted as an expert on foreign policy matters. And the president seems to have his ear on that. Going forward, what does this mean in Arkansas for the 2018 congressional election or other elections? Will Trump, Russia, Comey, any of this matter?
Hard to say, especially since we don't know what the eventual conclusion is going to be before the election in November of 2018. I spoke with Michael John Gray, though, the state representative and the chair of the Democratic Party of Arkansas. He basically said what we've kind of been saying, that Republicans are trying to play this distance game because they know that they're aligned with Trump and Trump is generally supportive, but they don't want to get too close to it. He said that in 2018, they're not going to let Republicans play that safe distance game. He says the answers from this hearing are that did Russia interfere in the election? Yes. Did the president try to pressure Comey about the investigation? Yes. And they're alarmed that the GOP is not alarmed about election integrity on this issue. But here's his statement about Cotton dining with the president.
It's interesting that Senator Cotton has dinner with the president and then has questions for Director Comey that can't be answered publicly. It's like, did President Trump give Senator Cotton those questions to ask? Was there some conversation that led to those questions? But generally, from our entire delegation, I'd like to see more of putting politics aside.
There's been a few Democratic congressional candidates announced so far, and all of them are critical of Trump, but they have to win voters that voted for Trump last election. So I guess they're hoping that those Trump voters change their mind about the guy. Otherwise, I don't know if that kind of attack will work amongst people that like him.
The thing with Trump is that he doesn't seem to be as detrimental to the Republican base as either Democrats or anxious Republicans would assume or would fear. So I'm not sure that these hearings right now have damaged the Republican brand as much as historically such hearings would have, and especially here in Arkansas, where the Republican brand is very strong. I think it's, in a way, it's still ascendant from 2010, when there was the beginning of the sea change from Democratic majority to Republican majority in the congressional delegation.
Well, we'll see what happens going forward. Obviously, it's still a long way off before the 2018 election to see if this has any political ramifications. We'll keep you updated. So we want to touch on a few kind of disparate items around the state, but all with some political ramifications. First off, we should mention, you know, Arkansas has kind of this unfortunate reputation of being kind of home for sort of right-wing extremists or white separatists or white nationalists, what have you. And further evidence of this pattern in Batesville this Saturday, a group of neo-Nazis is planning a rally as other rallies around the nation are being held protesting Islam or Sharia law. Jacob, you've been kind of following this. What's going to happen?
Okay. There's like 30 cities in the nation or something are part of this ACT America group. They're anti-Sharia law. They're kind of mainstream-ish, although they certainly don't respect Islam as a religion at all. But Billy Roper, who's a local white supremacist type guy for several years now, used to be a high school teacher before his views became more widely known. He volunteered to be the guy that runs this one in Arkansas. You know, that national group has no idea who he is. You know, he just made a Facebook group basically as part of the ACT America thing. So this group found him to be too extreme for their already somewhat extreme views, and they disassociated themselves with it. But Billy Roper is his name. He leads this group called the Shield Wall Network, and he's going to have a Draw Muhammad cartoon contest along the banks of the White River. So those, of course, have drawn violence throughout the rest of the world. And as a response, the people in Batesville, some business leaders and stuff like that, and the Independence County Democratic Party as well, as vocal in this, they've planned a counter rally on the other bank of the White River. So they might be able to see each other across the water, and they're going to march around town as well, because they don't want Batesville to be thought of as like a white supremacist hotbed or anything like that. And nationally, there's been this movement among the alt-right or whatever you want to call it, white nationalists, that a lot of these factions really hate each other, even though they have the same goals of like a white nation and white people being the basis for citizenship. So it'll be interesting to see if the Confederate Southern Nationalist people and the neo-Nazis and the Klan people and your regular anti-Sharia law people, which includes several state representatives, can put their differences aside for the purposes of this hate rally. And that's happened recently in New Orleans when they're taking down some monuments the past month, where these forces that once were opposed to each other are joining up.
And Bobby, Arkansas Public Media is going to be covering it.
That's right. Jonesboro reporter Ann Kenda, as well as KASU news director Jonathan Reeves, are going to go out. I think Jonathan is going to take the anti-hate rally, and Ann will be at the what she describes as the pro-hate rally.
That's probably a nice way to put it, actually.
Billy Roper was quoted this morning on Morning Edition, a report by Tom Gelton, saying, I forget the exact quote, maybe somebody can help me, but basically, you know, what we would like to do is have Muslims know that they're not welcome here, and they're not welcome in the state, and in fact, they're not welcome in the country, which is an extremely kind of radical kind of xenophobia. But nonetheless, I mean, it's drawing national attention in light of the larger national network of ACT America rallies.
The Arkansas Capitol will be getting a new monument expressly recognizing the Ten Commandments, which is being constructed right now. Michael, do you want to fill us in on what is going on with this Ten Commandments?
Well, the foundation has been poured. We got word this week that the construction had begun. The concrete foundation for this monument is now in place. And the Secretary of State's office says that it will probably only take about a week or so to actually get the monument itself assembled. So it sounds like this could actually be up within a week or so. This has been something that has been pushed by several lawmakers, and in fact, during the most recent session, they passed a law to try and stop any other religious groups from putting up a display. In particular, there was a Satanist group that wanted to put up a statue of
Baphomet.
Baphomet. Thank
Someone you.
You
think about regularly, Bob?
I did not chime in that quickly because this is a regular part of my theology.
But it's happening. The ACLU, though, has promised legal action, but nothing has taken place at this point. And this law that was passed by the legislature basically requires the legislature to approve the addition or removal of any monuments on the Capitol grounds.
And we should note that it's being funded, the monument, the construction thereof, is being funded privately through a foundation.
Before this law, they used to also be able to go through a Capitol Arts and Grounds Commission. They didn't require legislative approvals. But Oklahoma, they had a Ten Commandments monument, and it was also installed first before it was eventually removed.
We'll see what happens, but the ACLU, it's taken a while for them to take action. But they, when they're contacted this week, said that, yes, we're going to pursue legal action.
Speaking of construction and concrete and pouring foundations for things, there are apparently crumbling roads in our state, and the State Highway Commission is hoping to boost a ballot proposal for the next election that would fund highways in the state. This has, of course, been a legislative battle that failed in the most recent session to put a proposal before voters to raise a sales tax. Michael, can you fill us in a little bit about what this proposal is about?
Well, the legislature did not pass a proposal that would have put a 20-year bond issue on the ballot. So now the Highway Commission has decided that they're going to pursue putting one. There are a lot of details still to be determined, but at Wednesday's meeting, they decided to move forward with this. And in the coming months, they'll be doing research about how much money to ask for, whether or not this will be an initiated act or a constitutional amendment. And it's looking like this will be for about $400 million, which is twice what the legislature was considering. But the Highway Department has said that, you know, revenue has been flat. A lot of factors come into play, cars getting better gas mileage than they used to. There are factors that are involved in just not enough money, the Highway Department says, coming in to maintain and continue construction plans that are underway. So they're going to spend the next several months working on exactly what they want to do. Then they will have to collect signatures to get the required number to put this on the ballot, and then we'll submit language to the Secretary of State's office by, I believe, March of next year.
Speaking of voter-initiated constitutional amendments or voter-approved amendments, of course, we had a major one passed last November 2016, the Arkansas Medical Marijuana Amendment. And since then, we've had regular meetings of the Medical Marijuana Commission to develop regulations. The Department of Health, the Department of Finance and Administration has been working on this. And we're getting really close to the point where there'll be some applications coming in for retail and cultivation centers. Bobby, you've been following the developments with medical marijuana in the state. Fill us in. Where are we right now?
Right. So in November 8th, the state passed medical marijuana, and soon thereafter, the governor and other leaders put together a medical marijuana commission, a five-member panel, two doctors, a lawyer, a doctor of pharmacy or pharmacology, as well as a political administrator and staffer at the Capitol. And so many of the developments have kind of come through this commission. So this week, on Tuesday, the Medical Marijuana Commission finalized the application processes that prospective business owners will have to fill out and supply the commission, who will then make merit-based decisions on who gets licenses for the 32 dispensaries. Those are the stores that will actually sell medical marijuana, and the five cultivation facilities. These are the farms, although if you picture a farm, you might be mistaken. I think these are going to be large greenhouses and other kind of very heavily enclosed kind of facilities that grow medical grade marijuana. It was a really contentious meeting, and I got to tell you, I mean, this commission is not a contentious commission. These guys normally get along, but there were a couple of 3-2 vote. Travis Story, the lawyer from Fayetteville, as well as Jim Miller, the political administrator and consultant, voted to the minority. They wanted the commission to have more say in who gets these licenses. The other three took the advice of Department of Finance and Administration General Counsel Joel DePippa, who wanted really more precise kind of grading or number rankings on each section of the application. And the reason he wants this is that he, without saying this, and in fact, I think the clip we're going to play for you, he says he doesn't want to speculate on lawsuits, but there have been many lawsuits filed in other states that have rolled out medical marijuana around who gets these applications. Why? Because there's big money in these things. I mean, if you get a retail permit, a dispensary permit, or a cultivation facility permit, potentially, if you're successful, you could make millions of dollars on it. So he wants a lot of specificity in the commission's kind of grading rubric, he calls it, for the application process, because almost certainly there will be more than 32 applicants for the dispensary permits and more than five applicants for the cultivation facilities. So let's listen to an exchange I had with, again, Joel DePippa, the general counsel for DFNA.
I know you said it three times during the meeting, but say it again for the folks at home, the importance of, what did you say, subjectivity and...
The merit-based system is objective. The point of a merit-based system is objectivity, and it's both in the level of scoring provided by, in this case, commissioners, but also for the applicants who are able to create their application with knowledge of what is sought.
If a lawsuit were to come about, do commissioners have to do what?
I wouldn't want to comment on what would happen if a lawsuit were to occur.
I thought you were advising them that they would have to be able to justify their scoring.
All merit criteria scoring should be able to be justified by reasonable explanation. All good merit-based scoring is objective, and you can pull it out of a desk years later, give it to someone new, and have a result that is substantially similar to what originally occurred.
So again, that was Joel DePippa basically saying, naturally, the commissioners want to treat the applications, I think, much the same way a college professor would treat a stack of term papers, that they each get to kind of weigh in and make their score, like A, B, C, or D. DePippa's point was, if a lawsuit were to occur after the fact, they need to take all the applications and present them as evidence and say, this scoring was consistent at every step of the way. So there was no wrongdoing, no appearance of favoritism. These were scored objectively. And naturally, the commissioners seek for subjectivity. But the commission, again, sided with the lawyers at the department and basically made these merit-based applications a scoring rubric that's very, very precise.
Can you talk at all about the scoring rubric? I guess if someone wants to do this, what they're looking for, it seems my only takeaway from like 1,000 feet away is that it takes money to make money, sort of. They want really well-financed people.
These applications are not like going to Starbucks to apply to be a barista. These are 5 or 6 part applications. Each part requires a lot of information. I mean, everything from your plan for 24-hour security surveillance systems to your plan for transporting medical marijuana either to a dispensary or things like packaging, things like childproof packaging, all the way down to a plan to prevent the cross-contamination of marijuana plants. I mean, the amount of thought and explanation and supporting documents in these applications is severe. So a big chunk of the scoring has to do with basically your business model and your plans, again, for security, for transportation. And instead of just giving 50% of the score to that, they now have given each of those sections its own score, such as 9 points, 15 points, 5 points, you know, whatever the breakdown was.
And then there's other restrictions, I guess, once you get approved. If someone gets approved, they have to be spread out throughout geographic areas of the state.
Right.
And they can't be close to, like, schools and stuff like that, too, right?
Right. So there's 32 dispensary licenses, but you can't have 32 retailers just in Pulaski County. There are 8 geographical zones around the state. This was done for convenience of patients buying it, but it was also done because the promise of this program is millions and millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars of industry brought to the state, and they want to spread that out.
So what's the timeline?
So in a few days, by the end of the month, the application process, the window to begin applying will open. It will stay open throughout the summer. It will close in September, but not September 1st, in the middle of September. And then the commission will have some time to wade through the applications that may, you know, I mean, some of them are talking about hundreds of applications. I don't know that it'll be that high, but they need some time to wade through these applications and score them. Certainly, the commission hopes to get to the point by the end of the year that they'll begin issuing licenses.
I saw Chris do like a little grin when you said that they don't know if the number of applications will be that high. So do you have any freshly baked marijuana puns for us? you've been doing that in your headlines on in Arkansas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the commission will certainly have to weed through the application. There'll no doubt be a lot of rolled papers. And at the end of it, I think no doubt they'll find therapy in their local therapist.
It's been several months since the presidential election in November, and a lot of pundits and commentators have given their theories as to why Donald Trump won or why Hillary Clinton lost certain states, and et cetera, et cetera. One interesting study that came out this week by the University of Arkansas Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society looked particularly at sexism in the 2016 general election. I spoke with the lead researcher on this, Angie Maxwell. She's the director of the Blair Center, professor of political science. It was a major national poll conducted of 3,600 voters, judging how their level of sexism was an indicator of what political candidate they supported in the election. Now, the researchers used what was called the Modern Sexism Scale, which was developed by researchers in psychology in 1995. It's been used quite frequently. It's basically a list of statements. Respondents are asked to rate how they feel on a 5-point scale, whether they strongly agreed, were neutral, disagreed, strongly agreed. I'll read you some of the statements. Many women are actually seeking special favors, such as hiring policies that favor them over men under the guise of asking for equality. Most women interpret innocent remarks or acts as being sexist. Feminists are seeking for women to have more power than men. When women lose to men in a fair competition, they typically complain about being discriminated against, and discrimination against women is no longer a problem in the United States. Out of everyone who responded, 36% were rated as sexist. And this is, again, 3,600 people from around the nation. I asked Angie Maxwell how this impacted the election, and here she is explaining.
If you look at kind of the six major Republican nominees, there are massive gaps between the percentage of their supporters in the primary caucuses who, based on their answers to those questions, would fall into the high or sexist category of modern sexism, meaning they agree with all those statements. Ted Cruz and Donald Trump had the highest percentage. Cruz at 65% of his supporters, male or female, falling into that category, and Trump at 58, whereas Kasich's were only 32% of his supporters, which is below the national average, fell into that category. So depending on which kind of nominee you chose, there's really big gaps there. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders supporters, it was the lowest percentage, and those are at like 16%, and Clinton's were hovered closer to 18 to 20%. And again, see, those are big gaps between those Democratic candidates and the higher end of the GOP candidates. So that's one way. Second way is that if you look at Donald Trump, got about 84% of GOP primary supporters of those top six candidates to rally behind him for the general election, which when there's so many candidates, that's a real feat in of itself. There's that small group, that 15% that would not vote for Trump, that voted in the GOP primary, depending on where they fall on the modern sexism scale, will predict who they did support. So if they're on the really low end, then they might have flipped to Clinton or to Jill Stein, or kind of as it goes up, stay home, or go with Johnson, or a write-in. On the Democratic side, only about 74% of Bernie Sanders supporters flipped and went and supported Hillary Clinton in the general. The quarter that didn't, their modern sexism scores will tell you who they chose instead. So on the lowest end, they picked Jill Stein, but as it went up, there was about 6% who flipped to Trump and about 8% who flipped to Johnson. That's 14%. And those folks had really high modern sexism scores. So even though Sanders supporters as a whole had a low average, the ones that did have that modern sexism score, they did not flip and vote for her.
So in a way, unsurprising figures in some sense, but in terms of how voters may have changed their views and switched candidates was a surprise. And, you know, I should also note that the study looked at women versus men in terms of their rating on the sexism scale, modern sexism scale, as well as Democrats and Republicans in general. There was a 30 to 40 point gap between Democrats and Republicans on the modern sexism scale. Angie Maxwell is a researcher in politics in the South, and she's, I think, working on a book forthcoming about this and the tracing the origins of the differences and views on gender roles within both parties in the modern era.
I imagine some people like that were labeled as sexist based on their responses, or probably most of them would argue, like, that doesn't make me sexist. That is true. My feeling on that question is true.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, like the modern sexism scale, is that it's not really asking about whether, you know, you feel women should have equal rights as men. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's generally accepted in modern society, but it's kind of probing further into feelings of resentment or animosity towards women for seeking that equal place. And that's kind of where it was going. Obviously, we're coming up on the weekend here, so I'm sure there are plenty of weekend recreators out there who are taking to the Arkansas River Trail on their bicycle, perhaps. Michael, you have some news regarding the Arkansas River Trail.
Well, this is probably big news for people who do take the trail regularly. A key complaint has long been the section of the river trail where it takes people off the isolated trail itself, and suddenly they're having to ride on city streets with vehicles. And this week, the city board of directors took one step, which is key. They have authorized construction of a $1.1 million bridge. This will allow the trail to continue from the Medical Mile over there by the downtown River Market area, and will allow a ramp and then a crossing over Union Pacific tracks. And I spoke with Mayor Mark Stodola this week, who also said that there will soon be an announcement with Dillard's. Dillard's all along has not wanted to allow its corporate headquarters to have the river trail run through it. And apparently they are close to announcing some kind of deal. Mayor Stodola says it will not allow the river trail, at least at this time, to be built on the bluff overlooking the Arkansas River, which was his preference, but said that there will be a compromise that will at least let the river trail continue through that area. And he expects they'll make some kind of announcement sometime soon. Dillard's isn't saying much other than they want to work with the city on this, but they haven't really been amenable to allowing the river trail to come through in the past. This has been years of talk, and it's one of the reasons that a lot of people don't ride the river trail, at least novice cyclists and others don't necessarily ride it as much on the Little Rock side as the North Little Rock side, where it is continuous trail. So that's big news for a certain segment of the population here in central Arkansas.
Well, thanks for that update. With that, thank you for joining us. This is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. You can find us online, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check out our news stories at KUAR.org. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. In partnership with UAMS, we are editorially independent of both institutions. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Bobby Ampazon, who was joining us earlier, stepped out of the room, but we thank him also.
And our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks again. Have a good one.